MyAudiobooks.ai presents The 5% World, inside Europe's largest rearmament since the Cold War.
In July 2026, at a summit in Ankara, the leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization announced more than $50 billion in new defense procurements and industrial cooperation initiatives, alongside a pledge of 70 billion euros in military support for Ukraine in a single year. The alliance's Secretary General, Mark Rutte, used the occasion to put a number on something European capitals had been absorbing piecemeal for 2 years. The rearmament now underway across Europe and Canada, he said, sustains nearly 200,000 American defense jobs on the strength of roughly $300 billion in orders placed with United States arms makers.
On the summit's margins, and in the months since, the same alliance has been negotiating a customs and standards push its chief calls Made in NATO, an effort to make weapons built anywhere in the alliance buyable everywhere in it. Europe is undertaking its largest rearmament since the Cold War, and the money is building two industries at once, its own and America's.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts. Turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. The scale needs to be stated plainly before anything else, because the words large and historic have been inflated by overuse. The alliance's members have committed to defense spending targets of 5% of economic output by 2035, a framework agreed at the previous year's summit that effectively doubles the NATO standard of 2% that dominated the last decade's arguments. For the European members collectively, the path from roughly 2% to 5% means adding annual military expenditure on the order of several hundred billion euros at the destination, sustained for a decade, on a continent that spent the post-Cold War generation drawing its forces down. Germany alone has created a special off-budget infrastructure of a €500 billion for defense over a decade. Poland is moving towards spending that approaches a tenth of its economy. The European Union's own joint borrowing instrument for defense, created in the mid-20s, was the bloc's first major step into common debt for military purposes, a constitutional Rubicon crossed at speed and in a hurry, because of what lies to the east. That geography is the first fact of the era. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022 did not merely start a war. It ended the assumptions of the 30 years between the Cold Wars, that enlargement could proceed without confrontation, that energy interdependence would pacify politics, that major war in Europe was a closed chapter. The war's conduct since has written the procurement list. Attritional artillery consumption at scales the West's production lines could not initially match. Drone warfare that put million-dollar tanks at risk from thousand-dollar aircraft. Electronic warfare that reshaped communications. And a missile and strike regime in which both deep rear areas and front lines are vulnerable.
Europe's militaries watched all of it through the specific lens of a continent within range of the same arsenal. The rearmament program is, in the most literal sense, a response to observed combat. Stockpile what was expended, produce what proved decisive, build the industrial base that can sustain both for years rather than months.
Section 1. The economics of rearmament.
Start with the industrial arithmetic, because it is stranger than the headlines suggest. Defense procurement in the alliance runs through two parallel systems that the Ankara summit attempted, imperfectly, to merge. The first is national. Each member buys for its own forces through its own contracting, with its own industrial politics attached. France insisting on French frigates, Germany on German tanks, Italy on Italian electronics, each with parliamentary oversight, offset agreements, and a jobs constituency. The second is American. A large share of the highest-end capability, the aircraft, the missile defense, the precision munitions, the satellite and command infrastructure, comes from United States primes, whose order books are now swollen with alliance demand.
The Secretary General's figure, $300 billion in European and Canadian orders to American industry, supporting on the order of 200,000 American jobs, captures the paradox at the center of the whole project. Europe's drive for defense self-sufficiency is, in its first phase, the largest single expansion of the American defense industrial base since the Reagan buildup, because capability gaps cannot wait for European production lines that do not yet exist.
The second paradox is fiscal. The same governments committing to 5% targets carry public debts near or beyond their wartime predecessors' levels, aging populations, and electorates that have not, in most countries, been asked to vote on the rearmament explicitly. The financing innovations are therefore the policy. Germany's off-budget fund, the European Union's joint borrowing, the proliferation of public-private structures in which states guarantee demand while private capital builds capacity, and, increasingly visible in the deal flow, the arrival of institutional money, pension funds, and private equity at the defense table for the first time in a generation.
The alliance's own estimate at Ankara, more than $50 billion in new procurement and industrial initiatives announced at a single summit, was framed by officials as a floor. An economy can be reamed for guns or butter, says the oldest line in economics. The 2020s answer is that a modern state can, for a while, finance both through the bond market, and the while is defined by how long voters treat the threat as real.
The third paradox is the one the Ankara summit put its institutional weight behind. The alliance that spends the money cannot currently buy from itself efficiently. Internal NATO trade in defense runs through a thicket of national licensing, export controls, certification regimes, and protected categories that make a European-built munition harder to sell across a NATO border, in some cases, than into certain third countries. The Made in NATO initiative, Rutte's push for a defense single market inside the alliance with harmonized standards and fast-tracked cross-border procurement, is an attempt to make alliance defense spending multiply within the alliance rather than fragmenting into 32 national fortresses.
Its adversaries are not enemies, but members. Every national procurement is a jobs program, every protected category a constituency. And the European Union's own parallel preference for European-built weapons sits awkwardly beside the transatlantic reality that the highest-end American systems remain, for now, the only ones deliverable at scale on the needed timeline. The customs union for weapons is the next decade's fight, and the Ankara Declaration is its opening document.
A single comparison makes the stakes of that internal market fight concrete. The United States operates one defense market of 300 plus million people with one certification regime, one export control authority, and one currency. The European members of the alliance operate 20 plus national regimes between them, and the alliance as a whole spans two continents and dozens of procurement codes. When a Dutch unit needs a German-made part under an Italian-maintained system, the paperwork can outrun the logistics. The alliance's own studies have estimated the efficiency losses from fragmentation in the tens of billions. Money spent on duplication, translation, recertification, and nationally redundant production, rather than on capability.
Made in NATO is, at bottom, an attempt to recapture that loss. But the harmonization of defense markets is also the harmonization of industrial policy. And industrial policy is the last genuinely national privilege European states hold. The fight over the weapons customs union is therefore a fight over sovereignty itself. The same fight the European Union has been staging in slower motion over banking, energy, and fiscal union, with the difference that this time the Americans are inside the room, holding the largest order book and a legitimate claim on the word transatlantic.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines. Section 2, The Arsenal Shortfall.
The most practical constraint on the rearmament, and the least glamorous, is production capacity, the unromantic problem of making things fast enough. The war in Ukraine's first lesson was consumption. Artillery shells at rates that exhausted the West's combined annual production within months. Air defense interceptors expended faster than they could be replaced. Drones consumed as consumables rather than assets. The alliance's response has been a capacity build-out measured in factories, new artillery lines across several countries, expanded missile and interceptor production, drone manufacturing scaled from boutique to industrial, and powder and propellant plants, the unglamorous bottleneck underneath everything, brought back from decommissioned status.
The numbers involved are instructive. A single modern shell plant costs hundreds of millions and takes years to commission. The alliance's target multipliers for key munitions run several fold over pre-war capacity. And the skilled labor constraint, machinists, chemists, explosives engineers, binds harder than the capital.
This is where the rearmament's timeline diverges most sharply from its politics. Parliaments can vote 5% targets in an afternoon. Economies deliver them over a decade. The personnel pipeline is the clearest example. European militaries spent 30 years shrinking, and the career structures, training establishments, and veteran pathways shrank with them. A force structure that grows needs sergeants and pilots in numbers that cannot be requisitioned from industry, and the recruiting shortfalls of the peacetime years have become the rearmament's quiet crisis.
The industrial version of the same problem is the supplier pyramid. Every visible prime sits on thousands of subcontractors, forgings, castings, electronics, energetics, whose capacity was sized for a peacetime market, and whose expansion is the rate-limiting step on everything above them. Rearmament, it turns out, is not a spending program. It is an industrial reconstruction. An industrial reconstruction has a physics that budgets do not waive.
The historical comparison deserves more than a sentence, because it is the only precedent at this scale. The American buildup of the early 1950s, rearmament under the first NATO framework, triggered by Korea, took an economy at full employment 3 years to reach the intended force levels, absorbed several percent of economic output permanently, and produced the celebrated failure reports of the era. Aircraft programs behind schedule, steel allocations fought over ministry by ministry, and a munitions expansion that was still incomplete when the war it feared never came.
The European economies of the 2020s begin from a weaker industrial base than America's 1950s, smaller defense sectors, less recent mobilization experience, and a workforce that has not been asked to think of factory work as patriotic, but from stronger financial positions and with technologies, drones above all, whose unit economics favor speed of iteration over mass of steel. The two eras rhyme in their constraint. In both, the money arrived a decade before the factories, and the political will must survive the interval between the check and the delivery.
Against that physics, set the alliance's one absolute advantage: the depth of its private capital markets, now pointed at the sector for the first time in a generation. The defense technology investment wave, the venture-backed weapon startups, the private equity entry into munitions and drone manufacturing, the bank-financed capacity expansion, is the subject of another of our investigations. Here, the relevant point is its systemic effect. For 30 years, Western defense industrial capacity was a planned economy inside market economies, sized by ministries and maintained through troughs by subsidy and consolidation.
What is emerging now is a genuine market. Demand signals from governments, supply responses from companies that did not exist a decade ago, and financing that does not require a ministry's balance sheet. Whether a market can do what the planned version could not, sustain capacity through the troughs that follow the peaks, is the open question at the bottom of the entire rearmament, and it will not be answered until the first peace scare.
Section 3. The Ukrainian Ledger. No account of the rearmament is honest without the line item that started it. The 70 billion euros pledged for Ukraine's military support in 2026, announced at Ankara as an alliance-wide figure covering equipment, training, and sustainment, is simultaneously a subsidy to European industry, a live proving ground for its products, and a strategic bet on the war's outcome. Much of the support is now procured from European producers. The artillery, the vehicles, the air defense systems, the drones, bought from the continent's factories with alliance money, which is one reason the rearmament's industrial base is scaling as fast as it is.
Ukraine's forces, meanwhile, have become the world's most experienced consumers of modern and modernized equipment, generating combat feedback that no exercise can simulate, and a drone development cycle that runs at consumer electronic speed. The alliance is, among other things, buying its own after-action report in real time.
The strategic accounting is darker. Every round delivered to the front is inventory not added to the Central European stockpiles that the 5% targets exist to fill. Every euro of support is a euro available for neither recapitalization nor debt service. And the war's outcome, frozen, resolved, or escalated, will set the threat model that the entire rearmament is calibrated against. The alliance's official language holds both truths at once. Support for Ukraine as the front line of European security, and rearmament as the hedge against the possibility that the front line moves. The 30-year lesson of the alliance's history is that the hedges that get built are the ones that get used, and the arsenals built for one era's war arm the next one. The current build-out is justified by this war.
What justifies it afterward is the question the parliaments have not yet had to answer, and eventually will. Section 4. What to watch. First, the national budget laws of 2027 through 2029, the years in which the 5% path must actually appear in fiscal legislation rather than summit communiques, watch Germany's coalition arithmetic, France's deficit constraints, and Italy's debt dynamics for the first cracks between pledge and statute. Second, the Made in NATO negotiation itself, harmonized standards and mutual recognition would show up as concrete agreements on cross-border certification, and every such agreement will be fought publicly by a national industry somewhere.
First, the American order book. If European demand begins shifting from United States primes to European systems as capacity comes online, the declared intent of several capitals, the 300 billion figure becomes the high watermark of transatlantic defense dependence rather than its baseline. Fourth, the munitions production milestones. The artillery and interceptor capacity targets that have been announced are checkable, and their achievement or slippage is the truest indicator of whether the industrial reconstruction is real. Fifth, the personnel numbers, recruiting, retention, and training throughput, which no communique tracks, and every general staff privately calls the binding constraint.
Sixth, the next Ukrainian winter. The war's trajectory and the alliance's support for it remains the forcing function behind every number in this story.
Section 5. The broader pattern and the open question.
The pattern is the return of the industrial state. For a generation after the Cold War, the West's model of power was financial and informational. Capital allocated by markets, force projected sparingly and precisely. Industry globalized and mostly civilian. The rearmament reverses the last assumption deliberately. Capacity, stockpile, and throughput are back as the measures of security, and the state is back as the customer whose demand shapes what industry builds. What makes this era's version distinctive is that it is being financed and organized like the economies that built it, through bond markets, private capital, alliance institutions, and a customs union for weapons, rather than through the command systems of the world wars or the permanent mobilization budgets of the early Cold War.
The West is attempting something without precedent, a market-based, alliance-distributed, democratically accountable arsenal built at Cold War scale
without Cold War economics.
Which leaves the open question, and it is the one that will define the next decade of European history. The alliance has committed to spend what it takes and begun to build what it needs on the premise that the threat is enduring, that the world east of the alliance's border will require armed vigilance for a generation. The premise may be right, but democracies have historically rearmed in one of two moods: the panic that follows a shock, which fades, or the resolve that precedes a war, which holds. The current build-out has elements of both, and nobody, not the ministries, not the industries, not the electorates, yet knows which mood is load-bearing.
If it is panic, the trough comes when the fear does, and the factories built in the 20s become the surplus capacity of the 30s, sold abroad or shuttered. If it is resolve, then the alliance is constructing the apparatus of a long confrontation it has not fully named, and the 5% world is not a destination, but a floor. The weapons will be built either way. What they are for is the question the spending has answered ahead of the politics. And the politics, in every alliance democracy, is where the answer will finally be given.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.